Beloved Master, when Daiten first came to Sakito, the Master asked him, "What is your no mind?" Daiten replied, "The one who speaks is it." At this, Sakito shouted, "Quats!" and left. 10 days later, Daiten again came to Sakito and asked, "The last answer I said to you was not no mind. What is no mind?" Sakito said, "Without raising eyebrows or moving eyeballs, bring your no mind here." Daiten said, "There is no mind to be brought." Sakito said, "Basically, no mind is. Why do you say no mind is not? That is the wrong statement." At this, Daiten was greatly enlightened.
First few questions. The first question: to us, are the words God and no mind synonymous? No, not at all. God can never be synonymous with no mind. God is always there, far away. God has been always referred by the word that, invisible, just a fiction. No mind has been always referred as this. No mind is your reality, your ultimate nature. God was a mind-created life. No mind is your truth, your splendor, your very universe. They cannot be synonymous. God does not exist, no mind exists. God is only a belief, no mind is an experience. God has been the cause of all your mental sickness, no mind is pure health, wholeness. The moment you utter the word God, you immediately start thinking of Him as a person, as a creator. No mind is not a person. On the contrary, your very personality disappears only then. No mind starts blaspheming. No mind is not a creator. It has always been here and will remain always here. It is always now. No mind is your eternity. Your very source of life, God, was just an excuse to exploit humanity and to keep humanity in a very subtle and invisible bondage. God has been your prison, no mind is your freedom. God has been in the hands of the priest, and the priests are doing the ugliest job in the world, because their whole business depends on a lie. No mind has no priest. It is simply there inside you. And once you experience it, suddenly you become aware, no mind is not your property. It is not your monopoly. The first experience appears to be it is your no mind, but soon you become aware that the no mind contains the whole universe. It contains the whole existence. God has always been an outsider. You cannot create anything if you are not an outsider. The Hindus refer to God as a potter. But the potter has to be outside the pot, only then he can create it. If he is inside the pot is already created. What he is doing inside the pot? The potter has to be outside, only then he can create the pot. And all religions have the same idea in different symbols, but God is an outsider. If there is God, you are only creatures, created people. Without God, you are Buddhas, uncreated people. God is the heaviest burden that man has been carrying, and because of that, there is no progress, there is no evolution. The heavy burden, the chains, go on pulling you backwards. They don't allow you to move faster to the higher peaks of evolution. God has to be completely demolished from your mind. It is an absolute necessity and urgency. Once you drop God, you will be surprised how many other lies have simply disappeared. He is the source, the foundation of all lies. Just watch God disappearing, you will see heaven has disappeared, hell has disappeared. Fear has disappeared, dread, greed, they are simply gone. God was the source. For the first time you can breathe at ease. God was judgmental. No mind has no judgment. God was continuously condemning you. No mind is a blissful, ecstatic state. God is just programmed into your mind. In Soviet Union, they program differently. They program no God. But both are programs. The atheist does not know that there is no God. Neither the theist knows that there is God. Both are belief systems, contrary to each other, but that does not mean one is right and the other is wrong. Both cannot be right, but both can be wrong, and both are wrong. An authentic man will not accept any belief system, either of atheist or of theist. He will explore on his own what is the truth. He will not like a second-hand knowledge. You never think about it. You will not like somebody else's shoes to wear. You would not like somebody else's clothes, second-hand, to wear. But your whole mind is second-hand. And not only second-hand, in fact, your mind has been going from hands to hands to hands for millions of years. Living with this mind, is not living at all. Your mind is borrowed, your life cannot be sincere and honest. Your mind is borrowed, your morality cannot be truthful. It will be only hypocrisy. Out of a borrowed mind, how can you manage any truthfulness, any sincerity, any authenticity, any originality? God is the oldest lie, and no mind is a fresh, original experience. God is nowhere. No mind is now here. No mind is equivalent to life, is equivalent to existence. God is against life, God is against existence. Can't you see all the religions are against life? They don't want you to live. Anything that makes you joyous, anything that makes you really alive, they start crushing it, condemning it as a sin. No mind simply allows you to be natural. It gives you an opportunity to be natural, to be relaxed, to be at ease. No guilt. No inhibition. No suppression. Nature is accepted in its totality. It becomes your very heart, your very being. There is no morality from outside, that outside God was creating all things from outside, imposing on you. And everybody around the world is carrying mountains of loads of beliefs, morality, commandments. They are all inventions of the mind. No mind is not an invention of the mind, it is a discovery. You don't have to invent it, it is already here. Just you have to be also here, and the meeting, and the transformation. And out of that meeting and transformation arises a totally new kind of morality, a new kind of spontaneity, a new kind of natural grace, a new love for existence, a new reverence for all that is here, surrounds you. But everything that comes from your very innermost being is being prevented by your God, by your priest, by your scriptures. They are your enemies. You have to take it very clearly. Unless you understand who are the obstacles, you will never reach to no mind. God is the biggest obstacle to no mind. Because of God, the God-oriented religions could not manage any kind of meditation. Because meditation goes inwards and God is outside. Because God is outside, all God-oriented religions have invented prayers. Prayers are for the outside God. And nobody has seen that God. Few people have pretended, either they were lying or they were hallucinating. But nobody has seen God. It is one of the most unproved hypotheses. And don't carry with yourself unproved hypotheses. They become very burdensome. As time passes, they go on gathering more weight. The weight becomes so heavy that you stop growing. There is no space left for you to grow. All kinds of rubbish furniture rotten surrounds you, you don't have any space to move. If God is there, you don't have any space empty. You don't have any sky empty. You don't have any possibility to evolve. There is no space where you are going to evolve. God is filling every place. That's why religions insist He is omnipresent. If He is omnipresent, then there is no space left for you. If He is all over, then wherever you go, you will be struggling against God. No mind is a pure space. It simply gives you an opening which goes on widening as your experience becomes ripe. Finally, you find there is only pure space all around you, infinite and eternal. And you can open your wings. It is your home. You can fly as high as you want. There is no weight dragging you downwards, dragging you backwards. The experience of weightlessness is synonymous with no mind. A strange Sufi story is a Sufi mystic was staying in a disciple's home. But he used to pray to God so loudly that the neighbors started complaining. In the middle of the night, he will start shouting so loudly. You have to shout loudly if you want to reach to an invisible God. You don't know where he is. Nobody knows his telephone number, nobody knows his address. Just blindly you are raising your hands towards the sky, which never answers, because there is nobody to answer. Looked scientifically, people who are praying to God are absolutely insane, neurotics. Because they are praying to somebody who is not there, and they are talking to somebody who has never been there. No answer ever comes. That Sufi used to shout loudly. Finally, the disciple decided that it is better to keep him in the night in the basement. So they arrange a bed in the basement of the house so he can pray as loudly as he desires. Nobody will be disturbed. But in the middle of the night, the whole neighborhood gathered. And they said, "Why you have put him on the roof of your house?" He said, "Roof? We have put him in the basement." But they went up to the roof. He was there praying to God so loudly. And when you are praying from the roof, naturally. Your sound goes on, awakening all the neighbors. The disciple asked, how you managed to come to the roof? The mystic said, I had to, because from the basement God will not hear me. Mohammedans have great pillars around their mosque, high pillars, they call minar, and the priest goes to the high pillars, because from the high pillars if you pray, there is a possibility God may hear. Hindus have in their temples, Tibetans also have in their temples, different kinds of bells, gongs. Do you know the purpose is to attract the attention of God? So give a good beating on the gong and God will be listening to you. Then after giving the beating to the gong or the drums or the bells, you can pray. In the Hindu temple, in the beginning you enter, there is the bell. And the bigger the temple, bigger the bell. The richer the temple, the bigger and bigger bells. Deafening sound. You have to do first the bell to wake up God and to listen to him. But you don't know where he is. Your gong, your bells are just resounding in the empty sky. There is nobody to be awakened. No mind is a reality that you can experience, but for that no prayer is needed. You don't have to look outside of you. You have to close your eyes and you have to look inwards without any idea what you are going to find. If you have any idea that this is what you are going to find, then most probably you will imagine and you will think you have found it. Go inwards without any prejudice, because all prejudices are part of the mind. Your Jesus, your Krishna, your Rama, all are part of your mind. If you carry any prejudice with you, you remain confined to the mind. If you want to transcend the mind and reach to the no mind, which is the ultimate consciousness, pure consciousness, the very essence of existence, but for that prayer is not of help, neither temples are of any help, nor scriptures are of any help. No philosophy is needed, no system of beliefs is needed, no theology is needed. All that you need is unload yourself from everything that has been forced upon you. Unload yourself. Unburden yourself. Drop everything that has been given to you by your parents, by your teachers, by your priests, by your leaders. Drop everything that has come from outside. Throw it out. And suddenly you will find your mind is giving you way. into no mind. You have only to drop rubbish, and God is part of the rubbish, the heaviest part. There is no possibility of God and no mind being synonymous. Here we are searching without any belief, without any hypothesis. We are simply going innocently into our subjectivity, into our interiority. As far as I am concerned, this is the only temple, your body. As far as I am concerned, your subjectivity, silent, peaceful, just an empty space, is the very source you have come from and is the very goal you are going towards. And when the source and the goal meet, you are enlightened. The whole circle, the whole pilgrimage is complete. You have left the source as ignorance. You have come back to the source again as innocence. You have again become a child. One birth is given by your parents. Another birth, you have to manage yourself. The second birth is the birth which matters. The first birth is going to end up in death. The second birth is the beginning of eternity. No death, no end, no beginning. No mind is the whole universe, and it is not possible to find this no mind by worshipping, by prayer, by believing. This mind needs you completely cured from all past oriented ideologies, from all organized religions, from all scriptures, from all that has been forced upon you . It is phony, it is plastic. Real roses come on the bush from its interiority. You can hang plastic roses on the bush, but they will not be fragrant, and they will not be alive. And because they are not alive, they are not going to die. They will just hang there. They are already dead. They are man-manufactured flowers. God is a man-manufactured idea. No mind is not your idea. No mind is not manufactured by man. No mind is a gift of existence. You can only be grateful. You can only be in deep gratitude when you find no mind. You will not find even a single word to say to existence, even saying thank you will look very superficial. In the West, it is very formal. You even thank you your mother, you thank you your father. Not that you really mean it. It is just part of formality. In the East, it is totally different. I have never thanked my father. I have never thanked my mother. It is so superficial. It is so formal. When you love someone, you cannot utter the word thank you. It will destroy the whole beauty of the experience. So when you come to know mind, you are utterly dumb. Kabir has a statement. He says, the experience of no mind is gunge keri sarkara, as if the dumb man has tasted the sugar. He cannot speak. He knows the taste. But he is dumb, he cannot speak. The experience of no mind is inexpressible . You can have it. You can dance in celebration, but you cannot say anything about it. Your dance certainly will shine with a new joy, with a new ecstasy, with a new drunkenness. Your dance will sow a new radiation, a new aura around you. Your eyes will be shining. For the first time they have seen something worth seeing. Your whole being will be throbbing with joy because you have come back to the original source. Let gods die. Don't carry on them. People are carrying dead gods, and when somebody is dead and you go on carrying, you start sticking. All religious people stink because they are carrying a dead body. There is a beautiful Hindu mythology. Shiva, one of the gods of the Hindus, one of the three gods, the trinity of Hinduism. Shiva's wife dies. But he won't accept the death of his wife. His mind was constantly telling him that if you go around the country, there may be somebody who can resurrect her. He used to live on the Himalayas. So he came down with the dead body of Parvati, his wife. The very word Parvati means daughter of the mountain. A beautiful woman, but dead. He carried the corpse around the country, asking everybody, is there any physician, any man of miracles? And the body was deteriorating, and soon it started falling into pieces. The legs dropped in one place, the hands dropped into another place. Hindus have 12 holy places. Those 12 holy places in the country are the 12 places where Parvati's one part has dropped. But even though parts were dropping, Shiva continued around the country. Unless he found that now the last part is dropped, it must have taken him years. But your carrying dead God is a longer pilgrimage, millions of years. And you go on believing that someday, somewhere, God will materialize. Meanwhile, go on carrying the corpse. The corpse is destroying you also, because it is rotten, and it is making a rotten humanity. God is a sickness. You have simply to drop it. But the only good thing is that you are carrying the sickness, so you can drop it. It is your belief, so you can throw it out. It is not something part of you. It is something that you are holding unnecessarily. It is not holding you. This is the only beautiful thing about it, that you can drop God. One day I dropped, and since then I have felt so weightless, so blissful. I used to carry the dead body myself, but as I realized the body is dead, no breathing, no heartbeat, it is up to me whether to carry it or drop it. And as I dropped it, for the first time I felt myself as an individual. The dead body was overwhelming me. It was covering me from all the sides. It has become my personality. For a moment I felt naked, because the personality has dropped, your mask have dropped. But soon I knew this nudity, this nakedness is natural. Everybody is nude behind the clothes. The moment you drop your clothes, have you ever felt a certain freedom? Just on the sea beach, as you drop your clothes, you suddenly feel the sun with your body, the wind blowing to your body, and a tremendous sense of freedom. Just by dropping clothes, which are not much weight, God is very heavy. It goes on becoming heavier and heavier as time passes. A moment comes, it is heavier than you. You are crushed under the mountainous load. Unless one is free from God, one knows not what is freedom. So God cannot be synonymous to no mind. No mind is really the antidote to the disease called God. No mind is your freedom. All chains dropped, all thoughts dropped, all feelings dropped. Suddenly you find only the purest essence has remained. All that was covering it, layer upon layer, has been dropped. This dropping I call meditation. Finally, only a witness, a sakshi, remains. Just a pure awareness. This is ultimate freedom, and the authentic religion is for ultimate freedom and ultimate liberation. God-oriented religions cannot even give you a sense of freedom or a direction for freedom. Their whole effort is to direct your mind towards God. Fill your mind with God. Repeat His name again and again. So it becomes ingrained in your mind. The more ingrained it becomes, the more difficult it will be to leave it. The sooner you leave God, the better. And you will have to leave one day. So why not now? One cannot live a lie forever. Only truth can be lived forever. You have to believe only in lies. You don't have to believe in the truth. Truth has to be discovered. I teach you purely the attitude of an agnostic who does not believe, who does not disbelieve, but who is a seeker, searcher, explorer. Certainly the first thing to be explored is your own inner being. That is the closest life throbbing. Everything else is a little far away. The man of intelligence first will look inside his own house before he goes searching to the moon and to the Mars. First he will look inside, what is there? And those who have gone inside have never come empty-handed. They have come with so much bliss, with so much ecstasy, such an abundance that they start sailing. Because as they sail, they come to understand the inner economics. The more you sail, the more you have. If you don't share, you won't have even that which you were having. Jesus says, those who have, they shall be given more. And those who have not, even whatsoever they have will be taken away. I cannot agree with him. I say unto you, the more you give, the more you will have. The less you give, the less you will have. If you don't give at all, you won't have anything left. Share is the only compassion. Sharing is the only service. Sharing is the only way the awakened one lives. That is real character. That is authentic morality. That is true religiousness. You don't have a God, but you become God. Hence I say, the moment you drop the God, you are moving in the right direction of becoming godly. You will be divine. In your ecstasies, in your silent spaces of the being, you will be divine. But you will be divine because you will be participating in the divine existence. Everything is sacred to the man who has come to know himself, who has discovered his hidden secret of life. Everything becomes sacred. A story is told about the mystic Nanak. He went to Kaaba, the holy place of the Mohammedans. It is a beautiful story. He reached Kaaba by the evening, but his fame has already reached. The people were waiting for him. They received him, welcomed him. But he was very much tired, so he said, I would like to go to sleep. I have been walking miles and miles. So they prepared a bed. Under a tree, but he turned the bed, because Mohammedans don't sleep keeping their legs towards Kaaba. And he turned the bed so that his legs are towards the Kaaba and his head is on the opposite side. When the head priest of Kaaba heard about it, he came running. He said, we thought you are a great mystic, but you don't even seem to be religious. You don't understand that you are hurting our feelings. You are keeping your feet towards the most divine and the most holy land. You should turn your feet. Nanak laughed. He said, as far as I am concerned, wherever I turn my feet, I find they are towards the holy land. Because to me the whole existence is holy. Now if you think there is some place which is unholy, please turn my legs. I am willing. There was this silence. The priest could not say that there is some place that is unholy. But this could not be tolerated either, that this man continues to keep his feet towards Kaaba. I think up to this point it is factual. Beyond this point it becomes more and more symbolical, but even that is significant. Finally the priest decided to turn his leg. And turned his head towards Kaaba. But they were utterly disappointed, surprised. They could not believe their eyes. Wherever they moved Nanak's legs, Kaaba moved. This must be symbolic, but it is significant. It is poetry, but it gives you the feeling that if everything is holy and sacred, it does not matter where you are keeping your legs. It will be always towards the sacred land. The whole existence is sacred for a mystic. Nanak showed his understanding very clearly. A man of no mind only can do that. A man of no mind knows that everywhere life is throbbing. In the trees, in the rivers, in the mountains, even the Himalaya is still growing. It is the youngest mountain in the whole world, but really powerful, because it has got the highest peaks in the world and they are still growing 1 foot per year. But that means it is alive. It is not a dead mountain. It is reaching towards a star, perhaps very slowly, because it is not a small mountain. And for mountains, even to rise 1 foot in 1 year is quite fast. Looked at eternity, if this Himalaya goes on growing this way, soon it will be touching stars. It won't be long. When you see life everywhere in the stones, perhaps fast asleep, so that you cannot feel it, perhaps a different dimension in the trees, so that you cannot understand it. But everything is so abundantly alive. All that you need is a space and perceptivity of no mind. God is your blindness. No mind is going to give you fresh eyes to look again at the universe. The second question. Nietzsche made the observation that when ordinary people are in an unpleasant situation, they always seek to get out of it with the smallest expenditure of intelligence. Is God simply the first and last resort of a retarded humanity? Yes. Absolutely yes. God is the invention of the retarded of the idiots, of the imbecile, of the people who want a shortcut so they don't have to exert any intelligence. God is the belief of the unintelligent. God is the belief of the unconscious. God is the belief of those who are still asleep and dreaming. The moment you wake up, all dreams disappear, and with the dreams your God will also disappear. No mind is waking up from the sleep of the mind. No mind is a sunrise. Mind has been a long, long dark night. And no mind blossoms into tremendous intelligence. Not intellect. Intellect is part of the mind. Intelligence is part of no mind. It is a totally different phenomenon. And when that fire of intelligence rises in you in great flames, you don't find any God anywhere, but you certainly find everything is sacred because everything is alive. So a great reverence for life, that's what I teach you. But you will know life only when you have touched your own life. Then you know the criterion, what is alive. Right now you don't know the criterion, what is alive. The third question, from my own recent encounter with death, I came across many stories of people from diverse cultures and of different religious backgrounds who temporarily left their body and appeared to observers to be dead. They reported seeing a being of light which was totally loving and compassionate. Could this being of light be the basis on which the concept of God has been created? No, not at all. This experience is authentic. It happens sometimes to people who have almost died, not completely, almost died. They see a luminous being. It is their own being. It is not God. In meditation, you will encounter the same luminous being without dying. Meditation is a kind of death. You are separated from the body, you are separated from the mind. That's what death does. You are separated from the body, you are separated from the mind. Suddenly you become aware of a luminous being, which you think is separate from you, because you have never seen such an experience before. If you had been a meditator, you would have recognized, this is me. You are a light, luminous body. Inside this body, a flame, an eternal flame of light. But those who have almost died and come back to life, because they don't have any experience of meditation, they think they have seen something, a luminous being. They remember it vaguely, faintly, a far away echo, but they remember it, they have seen something luminous. Naturally, they cannot conceive that they have seen themselves. So God is not based on the experience of people who were almost dead and came back again alive. But meditation knows exactly what has been happening to these people. They have encountered themselves, but because the encounter is for the first time and so quick that just like a flash it comes and goes away and they are back to life. Naturally, they think they have seen some objective, some person is standing there with a radiant, luminous body, because they have known only objects in their life, they have never known the subject. A meditator will not commit such a mistake. A meditator will recognize immediately, whether alive or dead, that he is the luminous, eternal life. The Sutra, our beloved master, when Daiten first came to Sekito, the master asked him, "What is your no mind?" Daiten replied, "The one who speaks is it." At this, Sekito shouted, "Quartz!" and left. Daiten is not yet enlightened, but he must had been a great scholar. He has read in the scriptures that the no mind is one from where all that is original comes out. When a Buddha speaks, he is not speaking borrowed words, his speaking is coming from no mind. No mind is flowing in his words. Hence the beauty, the same ordinary words on the lips of a Buddha certainly become magical, alive. Very ordinary words suddenly take a totally different flavor, a new fragrance. They start being poetic. They have around them a certain aura. That's why the words of a Buddha start ringing bells in your heart. He is not speaking strange words. You know those words, you use those words. But when a Buddha speaks those same words, because they are coming from no mind, they carry some space around them. That makes the awakened one's words so authoritative. The awakened one is not authoritative. He does not command you. He does not give quotations from the scriptures to support as an evidence he is his own authority. I have been telling stories, and people who don't understand me have sometimes written me that your stories go on changing. Sometimes you say something, sometimes your story completely changes. They are only listening to mere words, not to me. They are blind people, they cannot see that my story is a response to the people whom I am talking. In the present moment, it takes a new shape, a new meaning, a new dimension. My stories go on changing because life goes on changing. What I can do about it? Sometimes it is spring and there are all over flowers, and sometimes it is not spring and trees are standing naked without any leaves. What can I do? Life goes on changing. My stories are not dead. They are as alive as I am alive, and they are coming from a living source. And they have told me, great scholars and professors, linguists belonging to different religions, that I liked your story, but it is not in the scriptures at all. I said, then you should put it. Your scripture is not growing. It is dead. If you like the story, if you felt there is some meaning, then put it in your scripture. Buddha is not the end of the world. There are going to be Buddhas after Gautam Buddha. There will be Buddhas after me, after you. And certainly they are going to continuously improve. It is not an effort, it is a spontaneous phenomenon. When I start the story, I don't know what shape it is going to take. I am as much surprised as you are that, my God, this story is not the story I have heard before. But what can I do? It is not my mind, Mind has a memory system. So it goes on repeating the same gramophone record. And gets stuck at the same point each time. If it is an ancient gramophone record, the needle goes on stopping at the same place. You start again it will stop at the same place. Once I was participating as a student in an inter-university competition for eloquence, I was the first one to speak, and the second person came from the Sanskrit University of Varanasi. It is devoted completely to Sanskrit scriptures and language. But the student must be feeling a little inferior than other students who have come from different universities, because in the Sanskrit university they don't teach English. So he must have crammed one statement of Bertrand Russell in English just to make an impression. But he was nervous as he started. After 3-4 lines, he said, Bertrand Russell has said in English, and then he stopped. His mind went blank. I was just sitting by his side because he was the second person to speak. The whole auditorium was full of students and professors, and there was great silence when he stopped, and I thought I should help him, so I told him, repeat again. And when you have crammed something, you can repeat it only from the very beginning. So he said, sisters and brothers. So the whole audience started laughing. He again repeated those 3-4 sentences and came to the point, Bertrand Russell has said, and full point. I said, repeat. Finding no way out, he again started, brothers and sisters. And it was such a joy. 10 minutes it continued. And I will say, repeat. And finding no way out, and I was the only help, everybody was laughing. And he will say, sisters and brothers. And finished, everybody was waiting these 3 sentences. And Bertrand Russell has said, full point. Ten minutes finished, the chairman, the vice chancellor of the university, himself was laughing. And he told the boy, just sit down. Don't be worried, everything is okay, just sit down. Because he was perspiring. And he told me that you should not have done this. I said, I was simply helping him. I never thought that he is a gramophone record. I thought sometime he may slip ahead. Bertrand Russell had said, but he proved to be a gramophone record broken. It was not my fault. And anyway, he has given such a joyous evening. Even if you give him the first prize, I am ready. Because he has given so much joy, nobody can give. Now scientists have found that your memory system functions exactly like the gramophone record. They have opened the brain for other reasons, but somehow they found that if they put an electrode on the memory point in your brain, you start saying something and they take the electrode away, you stop. And your brain automatically reverses. Again they put the electrode, you start from brothers and sisters. Again the same. Take the electrode off and you start. And they discovered that, the mind has an automatic reverse system. Once you have stopped, it goes back to its original place. You touch that spot again and the person starts speaking the same. No reason why he is speaking. Nobody has asked anything, but he is helpless. The memory starts repeating like a record. Dayaten must have been a scholar. He has been quoting this sentence not from his own experience, but from scriptures. What he is saying, when Sekito asked him, "What is your no mind?" Dayaten replied, "The one who speaks is it." One who speaks originally. If one speaks only that which is borrowed, it is from the mind. But if one speaks originally, spontaneously, then it is coming from the space called no mind. But he forgot the word originally. That happens to scholars. It cannot happen to a Buddha. Whatever is coming, is coming from the very source. But when you are repeating a scripture which is not your experience, there is going to be some difficulty. If he had said, "The one who speaks spontaneously," that is the place of no mind. That one word, original, he has forgotten. And perhaps it was not written in the scripture itself. But because no Buddha has written a single word, all scriptures have been compiled by their disciples, sometimes after the death, sometimes hundreds of years have passed, and then disciples of disciples, generations have passed. The four Gospels of Jesus are recorded after his death, and not immediately. 300 years afterwards. Now nobody is a witness. All witnesses are dead. And these Gospels were recorded by people who have not seen Jesus. They have not even seen Jerusalem. Because now biblical research scholars have found that even the geography that they are mentioning in the four Gospels is wrong. These people have never been to Israel. They have heard from others, who have heard from others, who have heard from others. That's why I have spoken on Thomas' Gospel, which was written in India, but he was a direct disciple of Jesus. And it is not included in the Holy Bible. It has been just discovered 30 years before. But it is the most beautiful. Because at least Thomas was a witness. And it has tremendous beauty. Because it is not only that he was a witness to Jesus, here in India, he went through a transformation. He meditated, he practiced the yoga, he lived like a sannyasin. And moved from monastery to monastery. Buddha's air was still there. Buddha was gone 500 years before, but his fragrance was still alive. So in his gospel, there is a certain authority which is lacking in the four Gospels of the Bible. Because first, he is the witness, he has heard Jesus, and secondly, he himself has experienced the truth. The combination of both gives to the fifth Gospel of Thomas a greater authority than the Holy Bible. And he is the only man in the whole world whose body has not deteriorated. His body is still in a church in Goa. Every year, Christmas time, his body is brought out of the church. His coffin is opened for any observer, for any scientist, for any researcher. And nobody has been able to figure it out, how it looks so fresh as if it has died just now. There seems to be no device used. It is not kept in a freezing temperature. It is in a hot country, but not even the skin shows as if it is dead. He looks so fresh. I have been to see the body. Jesus' miracles may have been a myth. But this man really managed to do a miracle after 2,000 years. He is the only person around the world whose body looks as if it has died just now, or perhaps he is fast asleep. No smell, no, and if it can remain for 2,000 years, there is no problem for it to remain forever. Just care has to be taken that nobody distorts it. There have been efforts to distort it by Hindus, by Mohammedans, by people who are not Christians, because it is a great argument in favor of Christianity. But the man Thomas was not a Christian. He never knew about Christianity. He came just after Jesus was crucified. He left Jerusalem for the simple reason that Jesus must have been telling to his close friends, and Thomas was one of those who were very close to him, about India and about the universities of Nalanda and Takshila and about meditations. So as he saw that Jesus is crucified, now there is no point to be here, he left. But he came on a ship. So he landed in South India. But he traveled all over India, met all kinds of mystics who have been deeply rooted in meditation. His body is a proof that he must have followed a certain method which was known to the Tibetan Lamas, to the Ladakh people, they used to do a certain method of meditation, and when the meditator is dying, at the last moment a certain process called bardo, it was nothing but a post-hypnotic suggestion. When the man is dying, he is in a very vulnerable state. And if he has been a meditator, then he is perfectly awake. Death is coming, but he is perfectly awake. If he can be hypnotized and told that when you leave your body, the body will remain intact as it is, you have to continue repeating, so it enters not only in his mind, it enters even into his bones, into his marrow, into his blood. Bardo is a very intensive hypnosis. And it is also possible to give directions for future to the soul that is leaving the body. Both can be done. The body can be preserved by a post-hypnotic suggestion. But you cannot do it if the man has died. Then there is nobody to listen to the post-hypnotic suggestion. The man has to be alive just on the verge of death. And if you give him the post-hypnotic suggestion that your body will remain intact, will remain intact, you go on. And if he is a meditator, even your bones, your blood, your body starts listening. The soul will leave, but the body will remain completely as the soul left it. This was one way for the body, the bardo was used, and there was second way. You can give the suggestions to the living soul that what kind of womb will be good for you. Choose rightly, don't be accidental, because millions of people are making love and millions of people are dying. So those souls are roaming around finding a couple who is making love. This is accidental because they die unconsciously, so they unconsciously grope in the darkness, and whoever comes close by, just by chance, they enter into the womb. Bardo prevents the accidental thing. It gives it a right direction that you need a certain kind of womb. So don't be in a hurry. You have been a meditator and you have to find a mother, a father who will allow you to meditate. Not only allow you to meditate, will help you to meditate, who are themselves meditators. So don't be in a hurry. Choose a couple. So sometimes the man of meditation takes time to find the right womb. Ordinary persons immediately enter into the womb. Bardo gives two kinds of possibilities. The body can be kept, and the soul can be given a sense of direction, where to go. But this is possible only if the man has been deeply in meditation, has been practicing meditation for a long time, was capable of remaining conscious when death comes, because death is the greatest operation. So nature has managed that nobody should die consciously. Just as a surgeon will not be ready to operate on you if you are conscious. First he will give you chloroform or something that makes you unconscious. Then he can operate on you because you don't know what is happening. You are so fast asleep that things can be removed from your body, bones can be cut, replaced, anything can be done. Death is the greatest operation because the whole 70 years attachment to the body has to be broken. Nature has managed, this is the wisdom of nature, the intelligence of nature, that a person who is not capable of detachment with the body, who does not know that I am not the body, should be made unconscious. Otherwise he will be passing through tremendous anguish and anxiety. It is natural wisdom, but it is not applicable to the meditator, because the meditator can afford to die consciously without any pain, without any anguish, without any anxiety. When Dayatan replied, "The one who speaks is it," at this Sekito shouted, "Quartz!" and left. This shout says to Dayatan that shut up, it is not you, It is borrowed. I can see the deadness of your statement. Shouting quads is saying shut up, and then he left immediately, because there is no point in wasting time with this man. He is just a dead scholar. Ten days later, Dayatin again came to Sekito and asked, the last answer I said to you was not no mind. He realized. He was sincere, at least honest. First he had tried to deceive Sekito. You cannot deceive a master. That is impossible. He looks through and through in you. He knows from where the answer is coming, from the mind or from the no mind. It is so clear to a master from where the answer is coming. Any answer from the mind, quads, set up. He must have thought about it, why the master behaved in such hard way. And I was an stranger, a new person. Certainly there must be some reason why he behaved without any compassion. I must be wrong. And then he understood in 10 days meditation that what I said was only a repetition of scriptures. So he came back. 10 days later, Dayatin again came to Sekito and asked, the last answer I said to you was not no mind. What is no mind? Please tell me. I don't know. A authentic seeker begins with, I don't know. Because all that I know is not mine. It does not matter. I may have much knowledge, but as far as I am concerned, I don't know. This acceptance is the beginning of self. If you know already, there is no need to search, there is no need to see. Sekito said, without raising eyebrows or moving eyeballs, bring your no mind here. It's strange, but masters are strange people. They have their own ways of pushing you into the unknown territory of your own being. Sekito said, without raising eyebrows or moving eyeballs, bring your no mind here. Dayatin said, there is no mind to be brought. In the first place, I don't know what is no mind. In the second place, if it is no mind, how you can bring it? It is not a thing. It is not even a thought. It is pure awareness. It cannot be brought here as an object for your observation. Sekito said, basically, no mind is. You cannot bring it, I can understand. It is not a thing, it is not a thought. It is only pure isness. thisness, suchness. Basically, no mind is. Why do you say no mind is not? It is the only isness in existence. Because you cannot bring it, you think it is not. That's why I cannot bring it. You cannot bring it because no mind is the whole universe. How can you bring it? It is already here. This very moment, it is here. As it was before Sakito. Why do you say no mind is not? That is the wrong statement. Just say, I don't know. Say, no mind is not a thing, not a thought, hence it cannot be brought. But don't say, no mind is not. No mind only is. Pure is. At this, Dathen was greatly enlightened. Hearing this statement, that all that is no mind. Isness and no mind are two names of the same thing. This presence of life in the trees, in the stones, in people, in birds, this vast isness, this presence is no mind. You don't have to bring it here, it is already here. You cannot take it anywhere else. As far as time is concerned, it is now. As far as space is concerned, it is here. If you are silent, you will immediately become aware of it. This statement made such a deep penetration into Dathen, he was greatly enlightened. An authentic seeker, sincere seeker, who does not hide himself behind false knowledge, borrowed knowledge, who does not pretend that he knows without knowing, if he accepts, I don't know, he is already very close to the truth. He has accepted his innocence. Now there is no barrier, no God, no scripture, no knowledge. He is just as close as one can be to no mind. A little push by the master, a little statement, and he will be drowned into existence. That drowning into existence is enlightenment. Disappearing into existence is enlightenment. I have loved always one story from China. The emperor of China was a great painter. At his 75th birthday, he was feeling old, and perhaps the day is not far away when he will have to leave the body. So he arranged a great competition before he leaves the body. a competition for paintings throughout China. First, in every state there will be a competition and one painting will be chosen. Then the final will be in the capital and the emperor will choose which is the greatest painting. He himself was a competitor. He has painted a beautiful painting. All the painters came from all over India, all over China. They all brought their great canvases they have done. Only one man came without any painting, just paint and brush. And a strange fellow. The emperor asked, "Where is the painting?" He said, "I don't like old things. I will paint freshly here and now. You have to give me a room because I don't paint on canvas. I paint on the walls. You give me the biggest room in your palace and don't disturb me and keep a guard that nobody disturbs me. I don't know how long it will take because it is going to be a spontaneous thing. I don't know what I am going to paint. I am just going to paint out of spontaneity whatever happens. However long it takes." The king said, "I am getting old, that's why I have arranged this competition. You have to be quick and fast." He said, "No, I don't know. It may be quick. Tomorrow morning I may inform you that the painting is complete, or it may take longer. And I cannot promise. No man of understanding can ever promise anybody." Because who knows about the next moment? All promising is in ignorance. The king said, "You are a difficult person. But I can see in your eyes, and I can see in your face, perhaps you will be the greatest painter." So he gave him the biggest room in the palace, and there were many big rooms. A plain wall, so he can paint, and the doors he closed. He said, "Nobody should enter, not even you, until the painting is complete. I will come out for the food or anything I need." And he kept a curtain also, that even the guards cannot have a look inside what is happening behind the curtain. It took 3 years for him, and the king was saying that, "What are you doing? I may never be able to see your painting, I may die." The painter said, "It does not matter. If you die, you die. If you are alive, you will be able to see it. But I cannot do anything in a hurry. The emperor has to wait 4 years past." And the painter came out one morning and said to the emperor, "The painting is complete. You are welcome." Such curiosity has arisen in the emperor's mind. 4 years he was thinking, "What that guy is painting?" He himself was a painter. It does not take 4 years for one painting. And when he came, the emperor immediately followed him. They went behind the curtain. The painting was just unbelievable. It looked so real. He has painted a huge forest. So green, less green, almost three-dimensional, and a small path was going, and you could see the path is going and going, and then it disappears into the thickness of the jungle. And the emperor said, where this path goes? The painter said, let us come with me. We can walk and see where the path goes, because without experience you will not know where it goes. The story is, both went into the path, and the guards were seeing, as the path turned around, they both turned around, and since then nothing has been heard. And when he came, the emperor immediately followed him. They went behind the curtain. The painting was just unbelievable. It looked so real. He has painted a huge forest. So green, less green, almost three-dimensional, and a small path was going, and you could see the path is going and going, and then it disappears into the thickness of the jungle. And the emperor said, where this path goes? The painter said, let us come with me. We can walk and see where the path goes, because without experience you will not know where it goes. The story is, both went into the path, and the guards were seeing, as the path turned around, they both turned around, and since then nothing has been heard. This story, in a painting you cannot enter. Is a symbolic story. It says, you can enter in the isness of things. The painter has made the painting so alive that branches were moving in the wind. The path was no ordinary path. And the symbolic meaning is, if you cannot enter into a painting, the painting is not worth calling a painting. But entering does not mean physical entry. Entering means you get lost completely. You are no more, only the painting is. That's how you enter into meditation. You are no more. You come across a tremendous isness. Everything disappears, you disappear, yet that isness remains. That experience of isness is enlightenment. This story simply gives a symbolic representation of enlightenment. A painter is not worth the salt if he himself cannot disappear into his own painting. Picasso is reported to have said that when I am painting, I am no more. Only the painting is. Nijinsky has said many times in his life, because he was asked again and again, that when I am dancing, I am no more. As long as I am, the dance is superficial. When only dancing remains and I am no more, then it has a tremendous quality. And it was observed by scientists, and they could see the tremendous quality whenever he forgot himself completely in dancing. He used to jump so high that gravitation cannot allow. Scientists were simply at a loss how to figure it out, because that much jump is not possible. And the more miraculous was his coming back. Gravitation pulls everything so fast. You see, every night you think stars are falling. All around the earth, 6,000 stars fall every day on the earth. They are not stars. Stars are very big. 1,000 times, million times bigger than the earth. If one star falls, we are finished. Those are not stars. Those are small stones which have been left hanging in the space. When the moon separated from the earth, once it was part of the earth. You have all these great oceans, the great Indian Ocean and the Pacific and the Atlantic. These all oceans are created because the mud and the stones and everything from these places fell out, because the earth was liquid. In the beginning it was liquid, and the moon is just the combination of that whole lot that has fallen out of the earth. But it created great oceans. Pacific is 5 miles deep. But when such great lumps fell out, many small pieces also fell out. Those small pieces are just groping in the space, millions of pieces of stone of different sizes. The earth has gravitation only to the point where the air layer ends. It is 200 miles. Around the earth, 200 miles, it has a gravitation, because up to that point there is air. Beyond that there is no air. It is pure space. Even air is not existent. Sometimes those small stones, and there are few big stones also. The stone in the Mohammedans' holy place Kaaba that they worship is also one of the stone that has fallen from the outer space. But it is a very huge stone. But in every museum you can find stones which have reached to the earth. But what happens when they enter by chance the area of gravitation? Gravitation pulls them so fast that the friction with the air makes them turn into a fiery stone, a fire. That's why you can see them up to a point and then suddenly it disappears. If the stone was small, then it will come up to a certain point and it will be burnt out. The force of gravitation is such, only very big stones can come up to the earth, otherwise they disappear in the air somewhere. Nijinsky's coming back was absolutely against gravitation. He came as if a feather comes slowly. So slow was his movement coming back. Both the things were against gravitation, first his jump and then his coming like a feather, as if he has no weight. Gravitation cannot work on it. And he was asked again and again. He said, I have tried, but whenever I try, it does not happen. So I cannot say anything about it. When I get completely disappointed and forget all about it, that one day suddenly it happens. When I am not trying to do it, it happens. I am not. Only the dance is. When I am not, and only the dance is, Nijinsky perhaps was the greatest dancer in the world. But this is the misfortune, that these people were born in the West. They had no idea that they were so close to no mind. They needed a master just to give them a little push, and Nijinsky would have been a Gautam Buddha, and Picasso would have been a Gautam Buddha. They have come so close, but West has no idea to go ahead, to go into the painting. Just move on the road and get lost. And that will be your great experience when you are lost. When you are no more, only existence is. And this existence gives you such bliss, such ecstasy, such eternity, that you are bound to feel a tremendous sacredness, a great reverence for life and this vast universe who has given birth to you, and one day it allows you to disappear again into the oceanic consciousness. This entering into the oceanic consciousness is enlightenment. Sikki wrote, the moon rises, leaf upon leaf upon leaf flutters down. Must be sitting under a tree, and must be a time for fall. The moon rises, he is watching the moon rising. Zen has many ways of meditations. Watch the moon rising. The emphasis is on watching, not the moon. Watch the sun rising. The emphasis is on watching, what I am calling witnessing, to make it more clear. Witness the sun is rising, and witness leaf upon leaf upon leaf flutters down. And you are just a witness. On one side the sun is rising, on another side leaf upon leaf upon leaf flutters down. And between these two, you are just a mirror. No judgment. He is not saying that the sunrise is beautiful, and he is not saying that the leaf upon leaf upon leaf are creating beautiful music in the air. No, he is not making any judgment. He is simply describing what he has been witnessing, just like a mirror showing you sun is rising and leaf upon leaf upon leaf is fluttering down. He is just a watcher. This is the whole secret of Zen. Manisa's question. Our beloved master, Saint Bernard, wrote, "Who is God?" I can think of no better answer than He who is. Eckhart stated, "Thou must love God as not God, not spirit, not person, not image, but as He is, a sheer, pure, absolute one, sundered from all two-ness, and in whom we must eternally sink from nothingness to nothingness." If one substituted the pronoun He with it, would not these two Christian mystics be speaking the language of Zen? Manisa, you can change the He into it, and certainly they will be speaking the language of Zen. But you cannot do that. It is their statement, not yours. They are still saying He. They are not even saying see. It is far away. Although they have come very close to the point, that's why both the saints were in trouble with the Orthodox Church. Particularly Eckhart was tortured, harassed, threatened to be expelled if he publishes his books. His books were published after his death. Because of these statements, The statement is tremendously good, but still somehow the faint image of God is present. Who is God? I can think of no better answer than He who is. Using the word He and saying who is just very close. Only the He is standing in between. That's what I have been telling you. Even a very thin concept of God as a person is going to create enough barrier for you. Saint Bernard has come very close, but to be close is still to be at distance. Closeness is a kind of distance. What does it mean? You may be 1 inch away, or 1 mile away, or 1,000 miles away. You are away. Even 1 inch away, you are away. That 1 inch is as thick as the China Wall, solid rock. When Saint Bernard says, He who is, using the word he accepts a personality. And also not only a personality, but a male personality. Both are wrong. Existence is neither male nor female. It expresses in the both, as female, as male. But it itself is simply pure isness. Its expressions will be manifold, but its essence is the same. A woman in her interiority is as pure consciousness as a man in his interiority. If Saint Bernard has really experienced isness, he would not have used the word God or He. It seems he must have been a great giant, but only intellectual. Philosophers have come many times very close, but then they go on in a round and go far away. Just coming close is not enough. But even this was condemned by the church, by the Pope. Certainly Saint Bernard has some conception of a male God, and you cannot change his statement. If you change his statement, then it comes exactly what Zen is. But then it will not be the statement of Saint Bernard. It will be your statement. So I would say that he had come very close, but because of the God and the programming in the mind of the Christian God was still there, that prevented him from the quantum leap from mind to no mind. His idea is still within the mind. He has logically and rationally worked out that if God is there, He can only be described as He who is. But this is not exact experience. The exact experience will not use the word God, will not use the word He. It is male chauvinistic, and it gives a personality to existence which it has not. It is infinite, so it cannot have a personality. It cannot be called who, and it cannot be called he. So Saint Bernard is still not enlightened. Intellectually great, logically great, but existentially is still a little far away from the truth. Eckhart comes even more closer, maybe just a fragment of an inch. When he says, thou must love God as not God. Not a spirit, not person, not image, but as He is. A sheer, pure, absolute one, sundered from all two-ness, and in whom we must eternally sink from nothingness to nothingness. He has come very close than Saint Bernard, and hence he was more condemned than Saint Bernard, because he is destroying the whole Christian theology. But still I say, he is within the framework of the Christian God. Although he seems to be a far more refined intellect than Saint Bernard. Very thin barrier. Japanese rice paper barrier. But that is enough to keep your eyes closed. His statement is beautiful. Thou must love God as not God. But why use the word God at all? If it is to be loved as not God, why not say, thou must love not God, not spirit, not person, not image, but just the sheer existence, pure, absolute, one, sundered from all two-ness, and in it we must eternally sink from nothingness to nothingness. But his beginning, thou must love God, is a Christian programming. Zen has dropped all programming. It has dared as much as human consciousness is capable of. Now, making this statement has a certain compromise with the church. Thou must love God, so the Christian church is satisfied that he is still talking about God, although a little crazy, Because he says you must love God as not God, then how? Who he is? A woman? A man? A tree? The ocean? What do you mean by not God? Christianity condemned him, but because he was saying thou must love God, they told him not to publish such writings while you are alive, because they will create doubt in people's minds. And they have been doing that even today. They prevented one great French scientist, Charnin, not to publish his papers about the Peking man. He has discovered the Peking man, because your papers will go against Christianity. And because he was an ordained priest, he has to follow the orders from the Vatican. They destroyed a great man. He could have contributed much, but if you cannot know the feedback, if other scientists don't know what you are writing, what you are discovering, and you don't know their opinions, it is a constant feedback. Science grows not by one scientist. It grows amongst all the scientists. There is a constant dialogue going on through papers, through conferences, through books, through periodicals. A constant dialogue is happening all around the world. That's how science tries to figure out the best hypothesis about anything. Now, preventing Chardin not to publish any paper, not to attend any conference, not to write any book, while you are alive, and of course when you are dead, somebody else will write it, you will not. And somebody else does not has the same scientific background, neither the same discovery. And after your death, what happens to your ideas will not be a feedback. You cannot improve upon it. They destroyed a great scientist of the same caliber as Albert Einstein. But I am also angry at Chardin, that rather than stopping his writings and researches, why he should not have resigned from being a Christian priest? He resigned science in favor of Christian superstition. Nobody has raised the question that he is also part of the whole slavery game. Everybody has condemned the Vatican. I condemn Vatican, but I also condemn Chardin. More Chardin than Vatican. Vatican has been doing that since centuries. That is not new. But why Chardin was such a sheep? Why he could not gather the courage? A man of tremendous intelligence should have left the priesthood. What was in it? And a religion that prevents you from declaring truth is not worth being part of it. But he proved a coward. He stopped writing, and now a Chardin society exists in France, which publishes his works and papers and his researches, but it is too late. If somebody raises a question, Chardin is not there to answer. And by the time Chardin died, other scientists have come to better hypotheses. If he was allowed, or if he had the guts to come out of the church, he would have managed to refine. It is a continuous growth and evolution. Science is not something static. When Albert Einstein was asked that if you had not discovered the theory of relativity, do you think it would have been discovered ever? Albert Einstein said it would have taken not more 3 weeks. And finally it was found that somebody in Germany has already found it before Albert Einstein. But he was a lazy guy, did not publish the paper. So not after 3 weeks, 3 weeks before it was found. And Einstein was right, that when something is there, sooner or later it has to be discovered. You cannot go on missing it if there is a truth in it. Eckhart also proved a little coward, just like Chardin. He has come very close, but he maintained continuously that he is loving God. Of course, he has those conditions, as not God, then as what? And if you are loving only isness of existence, then why go on calling it God? Why continue that old superstition, that old lie? Just a compromise with the Vatican. Just a fear that if you don't do that much, you are taking a risk for your life. I was born in Jainism, and when I started speaking against their ideologies, and when I say anything, I say with my total being, and they were unable to answer me. Their highest command decided to expel me from Jainism. But I wrote to them that you need not expel me, I expel your whole Jainism and your whole Jaina society. You need not expel me, I am already expelled you. So they were at a shock. They could not figure out what to do. They cannot expel me, I am already outside, what does it matter? And I don't think it has done any harm to me. Compromise is always covered. Truth never compromises. Manisha, these both people were very close to Zen, but both were cowards. God makes people cowards. Religion makes people cowards. Otherwise, what was the risk? Eckhart should have left Christianity. Saint Bernard should have left Christianity. And then they would have been exactly the first Zen masters in the West, but they missed that great opportunity, that great dignity. They remained slaves of the Christian Church. I want you to be lions and not like sheep, as Jesus wanted you to be. He has insulted humanity very badly. It is time for Sardar Gurdayal Singh, a really great time. Put on the lights, because I want to see the faces of my people laughing. 3 women, Betty Boobs, Lucy Legs, and Nellie Knickers, meet an old high school reunion. They soon start gossiping about the men they have married and what they are like in bed. "My husband Bob," says Betty Boobs, "is like a 1989 Rolls Royce. Comfortable, sizable, powerful, and very satisfying." "My husband Larry," says Lucy Legs, "is like a 1970 Cadillac. Is still fairly comfortable and satisfying, but lacks performance sometimes. Generally, quite a good ride." "My husband Norbert," says Nellie Knickers, "is like a vintage Model T Ford." "Really?" say the other two, staring at Nellie in amazement. "Why do you say that?" "Well," continues Nellie, "what I mean is, he manages to rally twice a year. But he has to be started by hand." "On the first 42nd floor of the Fast Buck Brokers building, Executive Vice President Bilbo Ballbag is interviewing girls for a secretarial job. After examining many talented and capable applicants, Bilbo finally hires gorgeous Gloria for the job. After 2 days, Gloria is bending down to get something from the bottom drawer of the filing cabinet, and Bilbo Ballbag gets an eyeful. He immediately calls her into his office. "Look, Gloria," he says, his eyes playing with her tits, "I wonder if you would mind working with me over the weekend." "Sure," says Gloria, giving Bilbo a wink. "That would be great." "Good," replies Bilbo. "We can get all this extra work done aboard my luxury sailboat." "Ah, dear," says Gloria, "but I get terribly seasick." "Don't worry," says Bilbo, perspiring as he loosens his tie. "I will take care of everything." That evening, on his way home from work, Bilbo stops in at the drugstore, he goes up to the counter and approaches Victor Veselin, the clerk. "Give me a pack of Trozan condoms," says Bilbo, "and a bottle of seasickness pills." "Yes, sir," says Victor, fumbling around under the counter and discreetly handing Bilbo the two items. "It is none of my business, sir," continues Victor, "but if it affects you like that, why do you bother?" Amongst the early Christians, it was rumored that the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ was blessed with an enormous sexual machinery which terrorized all his followers, men and women alike. As the story goes, on that fateful day on Calvary Hill, Jesus has been hanging on his cross for a couple of hours, staring up at the sky, waiting for Godot. He looks down and sees his favorite girl, Mary Magdalena, weeping in the crowd, and feels a string of the spirit in his loin cloth. "Mary, Mary," Jesus calls out, "come closer." Hesitantly, Mary walks out of the crowd towards the cross. She comes closer, but stops in her tracks when she sees the huge growing lump in Christ's knickers. "Mary, Mary," moans Jesus, "closer, come closer." Mary snuffles forward, nervously eyeing the ever-growing mountain in his underpants. Then she stops again. "Mary, Mary," gasps Jesus, "I have something from the Holy Ghost to impart you. Come closer." "Ah, Christ, no," cries Mary, her eyes popping out. "Don't give me any more of that Holy Ghost shit. I can see your resurrection from here." Close your eyes and feel your body to be completely frozen. This is the right moment to enter inwards. Gather all your energy, your total consciousness, and rush towards the center of your being, which is just below your navel inside, 2 inches below, exactly. With an urgency as if this is the last moment of your life, only those people have ever reached to their center who had this urgency, this intensity, faster and faster, deeper and deeper. As you come closer to your inner center, a great silence descends over you, just like soft rain with all its coolness. And inside you, a great peace arises. Peace that passeth understanding. A little more closer, and you feel so blessed. A little more closer, and you are getting drunk by the divine. Just one step and you are at the center of your being, utterly ecstatic. As you get centered, you are no more. Just a pure isness. This isness we have called symbolically the Buddha. This is your original being, centered, silent, no more your old being, utterly naked. Just a pillar of light, you are the Buddha. Everybody is born with a hidden Buddha in him. The word Buddha means the awakened one. It is everybody's eternal birthright. The Buddha has only one quality, watching, witnessing. Witness that you are not the body. Witness that you are not the mind. And finally, witness that you are only a witness, just a mirror reflecting everything. At this moment, you are the most fortunate people on the earth. Everybody is concerned with trivia. You are entering into the essential and the eternal. You can feel a tremendous reverence for existence. A great joy in the sacredness of everything. The whole universe becomes your home. You are not an outsider. To make your witnessing deeper, Nivedana, relax, but go on remembering that you are only a witness. As your witnessing deepens, you start melting into an ocean of consciousness. 10,000 Buddhas disappear into one consciousness, into one ocean of consciousness. Gautam the Buddha auditorium has turned into an ocean of consciousness without any waves and without any ripples, utterly silent and quiet. This is your real space. This is your no mind. From this no mind, you can enter into the cosmos. This is the door, the opening. Collect the peace, the silence, the blissfulness, the ecstasy, the divine drunkenness before Nivedana calls you back, and also persuade the Buddha to come behind you. He is your Dhamma, he is your nature. Just you have never requested him, and he has been waiting and waiting, hidden deep inside you. A sincere request, a welcoming heart, and he is bound to come behind you. This is the first step of enlightenment. O Gautam Buddha, behind you as a shadow, but the shadow is miraculous. The shadow is not dark, the shadow is pure light, pure presence. You can feel the warmth of it, you can almost feel the touch of it. It surrounds you with a new fragrance and it gives you a totally new dimension to live. Your everyday acts start changing their color, their approach. Your very life becomes meditative. At the second stage, Buddha comes in front of you and you become the shadow. To be a shadow of Buddha is a beautiful experience. And the experience goes on becoming deeper and deeper as the shadow disappears. At the third and final stage, there is no more of you, not even a shadow, only the Buddha is. This isness is the master key to open all the doors of mysterious existence that surrounds you. Once you have the key, you are the master of your own being. There is nobody above you. There is nobody below you. For the first time you experience a tremendous communion with the whole existence. I call this the only authentic spirituality, the only authentic religiousness. Now don't forget to request the Buddha to come behind you. Nivedana, come back, but come as a Buddha, with great grace, peace, silence, sit down for a few moments just to remember the golden path that you have traveled and the center that you have found within you and the opening into the cosmos and all those fragrances from the beyond, the silence sovereign on you, and the warmth of Buddha who has come behind you. You can feel him. It is your very nature. It is you in your truthfulness, in your existential experience. If the first step is complete, the second will follow automatically. When the second is complete, the third will follow automatically. The day you will complete the third step will be the most fortunate day in your life. That day you will be awakened from a long, long sleep, a spiritual sleep. That day you will become enlightened. Then there is no more birth, no more death. You have become one with the whole. This is the only holiness I know of. There is no other. Okay, Manisha?
Yes, beloved Master.
Beyond the laughter, beyond the tears, beyond the questions, deep in silence, beyond the answers, beyond the fears. Here we are, here we are, here we are, here we are. This, ah, this, ah, this.
Beyond the answers, beyond.
beyond the fears. Here we are, here we are.